Good evening. This week's show features Dr. Mandy Cohen, Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Cohen is a bona fide rock star who comes to us daily and to our homes, giving us the best information on COVID-19. When I announced she was a guest on Future Focus Now, the entire School of Health Sciences at Winston-Salem State University gave her a rampride cheer. Dr. Cecilia Hooper, interim dean, sent me a message and says, please tell her I said hello. Dr. Mandy K. Cohen was appointed to the role of Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services in January of 2017 by Governor Roy Cooper. Secretary Cohen is an internal medicine physician and has experience leading complex health organizations. Before coming to North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, she was the Chief Operating Officer and Chief of Staff at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Secretary Cohen has been recognized as a national leader for her work at DHHS. In February of 2019, Modern Healthcare named Secretary Cohen one of the top 25 leaders in healthcare in this country. Dr. Cohen, welcome to Future Focus.
Thank you so much, Chancellor. It's wonderful to be with you tonight.
I am so excited to have you on the show. You are indeed a rock star. Everyone at Winston-Salem State University is so excited. I can tell you the entire School of Health Sciences is cheering.
We love you
at Winston-Salem State University. So thank you for joining us. Tonight, we want to have a conversation between you and I. But we want to have a conversation, one, first of all, about you, because you have, in a short period of time, risen to be one of the more trusted voices in North Carolina around healthcare. And you've done that. And I want to get into how you did that, because I think a lot of it is attributable to who you are as an individual, but people trust you. I also want to talk a little bit about the Department of Health and Human Services, because sometimes we see you on television and you're always talking about COVID-19, but the Department of Health and Human Services is much larger than that.
Right.
And so we need to have a sense of the Department of Health and Human Services. And then finally, we have to talk about what's happening with the pandemic, and we'll kind of get into that. Now, let me tell you why I like you and why I think you're so great. You're so great. Because
wait a minute.
You're so great because this is what you said. You said, I came to North Carolina for the barbecue. Check. you said you want to use Medicaid dollars to buy carpet. I love it. And we'll talk about what that means in a moment. But that is fantastic. So welcome to Future Focus.
Thank you so much. And it's so wonderful to be here with the energy, and thanks to the whole student body for their support and the love. And I'm excited about our conversation tonight. I didn't bring my hat. So yeah. I hope you'll excuse me next time. I'll bring the hat.
Yeah, I should have warned you. This is something that I do just for the show, and I started doing it. And
I like
so
it.
Now I have, this is a new hat for you,
oh,
Dr. Cohen.
Very, it's very nice. I like it.
Right. Tell us a little bit about you. I know a little bit about your life. In fact, we actually kind of intersected a little bit. I know you trained at Yale. I also know that you also did your residency at Mass General in Boston. I spent 2.5 years in Boston at Cambridge College. So I know the space very well. You're a New Yorker. I know a little bit about that. So as a New Yorker, tell us how you get to North Carolina from the work that you were doing at the federal level.
Yeah, I mean, I drove here. It wasn't hard. it's actually not that many hours from D.C., actually, to Raleigh from D.C., which is where I was before. But no, I've been very blessed to have opportunities to both study medicine, but also think about how to bridge the world of medicine and policy and the administrative side of healthcare. And I thought about having those notions more than 20 years ago when I was an undergrad. And, you know, I asked a couple of now mentors, just people, to say, am I crazy? Think about a doctor kind of blending these worlds together. And they're like, no, go for it. And those are really important people, right, in your life. That when you're thinking about your future and you're in college and thinking, you know, I have a notion about what I think I can offer to the world, and just having those people at the right moments encourage you to say, yeah, that makes sense. And I think you can do it. So that was really important for me. So I had worked on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. while I was still in college. And so when I went to medical school, I sort of always looked for opportunities to bring those worlds together, the policy world and the medical world. I thought I was going to work internationally. I spent a lot of time in South Africa working on international HIV issues, but then realized we have a lot of problems right here in the United States that I can help work on, and realize I like being a little closer to home as well. And so that's when I, you know, as I continued my training, looking for opportunities to blend those together. And I trained as a physician, as an internist, and then went to Washington, D.C. and worked there for about 10 years in a variety of roles. Seven of those years was for the Obama administration implementing the Affordable Care Act. I mean, once in a generation change in healthcare that I got to be part of. Hard work, challenging, learned a ton, and I feel like had given me this great mix of now had a clinical background, had that work at the federal level. And when the governor offered me this opportunity here, I mean, I just couldn't have asked for a more perfect fit of what I thought I could offer to the state of North Carolina. And the opportunity that I saw here of all of the amazing assets here, but I thought I could help, you know, bring them together in a new way to help us build a healthier state.
Absolutely. And we're glad you're here. Dr. Cohen, you've been such an inspiration to so many people, but you've been an inspiration to women. And the reason why I say that at Winston-Salem State University, I hope, if you're not aware, that we're the third largest producers of nurses in the state.
I know that.
We have an extremely large school of health sciences. And so we have a lot of folks who won't come and want to be nurses. Mm-hmm. Tell us your story about how you got into wanting to become a doctor. I read your story. I heard your story about your mom. I know your mom mm-hmm. is a nurse practitioner.
That's right.
And so you decided not to be a nurse, but to be a doctor. And I think it's an inspiration and it's motivation for women. Take us through that.
Yeah, so my mom has been a nurse, started as a nurse, and has been a nurse practitioner for more than 40 years. She just retired at the end of last year after a hugely successful but challenging career. And when she was growing up in her family, her older brother was encouraged to go to medical school, but the women, it wasn't even a discussion. It was, of course, you'll go to nursing school. And she was very happy to go to nursing school and loved being a nurse, and then was one of the first in existence of being a nurse practitioner. She actually did that training before they even had the terminology nurse right. practitioner. She's sort of a bit of an experiment, and that she, you know, she saw that opportunity and took it. But I think it speaks to the time. I mean, back when she was, you know, 18, 19, that wasn't encouraged. And I think she imparted on me when she had her own daughter to say, you can be anything you put your mind to. Don't let anyone ever put a ceiling, or don't you put that ceiling on yourself, right? And she would say, no one told me I couldn't go to medical school, but somehow I thought that that wasn't something I could do. And, you know, you need people around you that can lift you up. And she has always been that for me, where she said, you can do anything. And I would say my father too, both were always say, you know, whatever you can be and make the world a better place, be a kind and good person and go out in the world. So that has been an inspiration. And look, she was also an emergency room nurse practitioner. And the emergency room is a really interesting place because it's both a really important portal for people to get care, but it's also where you see all the broken parts of our healthcare system and our society. The people who don't have access any other place go to the emergency room. A lot of challenges come out in the emergency room. And I saw that through her experience and her eyes. And so I always thought about an opportunity, not just to go into medicine, but to make all of the healthcare system better, because I saw those cracks and the challenges and how people weren't able to access the system in an equal way all the way back when I was a kid.
Oh, fantastic. Dr. Cohen, what do you say to young women, particularly those who are coming to Winston-Salem State University and they want to go into the nursing profession? Talk to them, what advice do you give them, and hopefully steer them into not only thinking about nursing, but thinking about so many other fields in the healthcare profession that don't get the kind of attention that nursing gets?
Yes. Well, I would say you chose a great field of healthcare. It's such an important field, and it's so foundational to everyone's life. You'll have the gift of being with a patient and their family at some of the hardest times in their life, and sometimes some of the happiest of their life. And that is a special gift. So know that. So you chose right to go into healthcare. But also be curious about the system in which you work and how all the pieces fit together. And remember that health is so much more than what happens in a clinic or a hospital. And I know we're going to talk about carpet and right, but I know that even though I had the opportunity to learn about become a physician, I very much know that health is so much more than the medicine you could prescribe or the blood pressure you check, right? It is about those larger things. And so I'd encourage everyone who is going into healthcare to go in with those broad thinking about that and recognize that housing matters and your job matters and whether you have access to food matters and transportation matters and all of those things, think about all that interconnectedness as you're thinking about healthcare going forward.
Oh my goodness, I got to get you to come to talk to our students. That was fantastic. I mean, that's a great recruiting tool and we have to use that. Dr. Cohen, I think that, and I mentioned at the top, that you're one of the more trusted voices in North Carolina for healthcare. And I think I figured out why. And that is because you're real and you're authentic. Take us through, because I heard you talk about your experience as a resident at Mass General in Boston. Take us through the story about the young lady she was your patient and what you learned. It moved me so much when I heard you talk about that story.
Yeah, it's a story where I did a lot of things wrong. And I think part of growing and becoming a better leader is recognizing when you've done things wrong. So I saw a younger woman, she was 24, full-time college student. And she came to see me for some complaints that I hear often from patients. She was losing weight and losing her hair. She's more concerned about the hair. right. And so I do what a doctor did. I went immediately. What is your family history? Are you taking any medications? I was perfectly happy asking her about uncomfortable things like her menstrual period. But I didn't ask her some fundamental questions, like I said, about that interconnectedness of her health. So I said, I don't really know what's going on here, but I did what doctors do best. I ordered a lab test. And frankly, I was a young doctor, so I ordered many lab tests. All right.
Yeah,
so
you were ordering tests, yeah. You knew
like,
it, right?
Let's order some tests here. I don't know. Could this be lupus? Maybe it's anemia or a thyroid. I ordered all the tests at the same time, which you're really not supposed to do. But I ordered a lot of tests and they all came back negative. They were all normal. But then she called me a few weeks later and she said, I'm not feeling well. In addition to the losing hair and losing weight. And for a doctor, that's a red flag. Losing weight and not feeling well, I started to think, oh, is something going wrong? Is there a cancer that I missed or something? So I even ordered a CAT scan of her belly, thinking, wow. What's going on in her? Is there something going on in her GI tract? CAT scan was normal. So now I'm seeing her back 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks later. And I am now, when I saw her, I was actually still training as a doctor. So before I went to go see her, I was talking to my mentor, right? The person who teaches me about being a good doctor. And I said, hey, I've done all these things. I don't know where to go next. And frankly, we were talking about, what other doctor should I refer my patient, this patient, this young woman to? Because clearly I've done some things I couldn't figure it out. I'm going to refer her to another doctor. Maybe she should go see, you know, someone around endocrine. Maybe there's an endocrine. We didn't know where to go. And as we're debating that, the nurse who checked in the patient, took her vitals and interviewed her, brings over, you know, the vital sheet with her blood pressure and stuff on it. And she hears us debating. And she says to me, I think you need to ask your patient if she has enough to eat.
Wow.
I mean, when I think about it breaks my heart every time I even tell the story, because I can see her face when I would then walked into the door. I mean, one, I was just unbelievably disappointed in myself that I hadn't asked her that fundamental question. Right. I went to some really good schools, right? I went to Yale. And I didn't ask her a fundamental question about her health. And, you know, at first you get defensive, right? As like the human reaction. She has plenty to eat. That's not the thing that's going on here. I know my patient.
Yeah.
But then I was like, oh no, I screwed this up royally. Right.
And her profile didn't fit someone that you would think that hadn't eaten or for a while.
That's right. She looked, you know, perfectly put together, full-time college student. I was like, oh, she would have brought that up if that would, but no, you have to ask about these fundamental, you can't make assumptions. You have to ask systematically. You don't know what's going on. And until I actually went in and asked her, you know, what was going on at home, which I will tell you is not what I teach my fellow colleagues and students. You have to ask standardized questions. I did it all wrong. I kind of went back in and was like, ooh, something going on at home. And luckily, right, I think she finally, as a patient, put the pieces together to be like, oh, what's going on with me physically and what was going on with me personally. Turns out that she had left an abusive relationship about several months earlier, was living out of her car. All her money was going to tuition, and she was afraid to call her parents because they really wanted her to marry the boyfriend, and she was ashamed to tell them about the relationship, right? I mean, all understandable things that had landed us in this place where I had a young woman where it was my fault that she did not eat for 8 weeks, right? I have to live with that.
Right.
But but it's a turning moment where you're like, okay, how do I change? Because I don't think I was a bad person, right? That's the whole thing. I wasn't a bad person. I wanted to help my patient. It was the system, right? The system around us, the way I was trained, the way we ask questions, the siloedness of healthcare and human services and all the other things in the community, we just don't talk the same language. We don't think about each other's issues. And so because of that, I wanted to think about how do we build a system that puts the person at the center, no matter what issue it is. Maybe if she's not having enough to eat, that is my problem as a doctor. In addition to, does she need medicine or tests and things like that? So it was a real important moment for me. And sometimes your failures show you the way forward.
Yeah. And that's become so much a part of how you operate and how you see the world and even the work that you're doing now. And isn't that, Dr. Cohen, so fundamental to a lot of things that we see, whether that's in education or so many parts of our systems? We assume someone is functioning a certain way without asking basic questions like, are you safe? Did you have food? Those kinds of things are extremely important. I applaud you for being in that space. You brought that spirit with you in how you see the work that you're doing in North Carolina, which segues very nice into my opening remark about the carpet, because that too is asking the right question. And when we ask the right questions, I think we get to some great, great solutions. So tell us about that.
Right. So we have to step back and say, okay, we spend a lot of money on health care, but are we actually spending our money on health? There's a lot of things, like think about the patient I just mentioned. I spent a lot of money running lab tests and a CAT scan. That's not what she needed. I could have used all of that money to help her with housing security, food access, right? So it's a mismatch of where we're putting our resources. So we need to just step back and say, look, we may need to use some of the dollars we traditionally think about as for healthcare to buy different things. So here's another example. When kids have bad asthma, they can often end up in the emergency room. Where is a really expensive place to get care? The emergency room, right? Back to my mom, right? Where they come in all the time. But that's not where you want your kids to be getting routine, good follow-up care. It's expensive. It's not at your primary care doctor's office, right? Then the kids are missing school. Mom and dad are missing work. It's just, it's not a good situation. But when certain hospitals here in North Carolina realized, you know, a lot of those kids were coming in because at home, their carpets were moldy. Or they had something else going on at home that was causing them to have respiratory or lung problems. And so instead of saying, okay, let's just keep paying for emergency room visits, they said, wait a second, I want to pay for free car. I want to pay for carpet in that kid's home. So I want to rip up the carpet, put down new carpet. And that's what I, when I say, I want to buy carpet. So that means I want to use some of the healthcare dollars to actually buy things that keep people healthy, even if it's not the traditional thing like a medicine or a lab test that you would think about. So that's the, you know, just bring a little of that common sense to our thinking. And that's one really classic example, but there's others that we can think about along the way. And that was, you know, the work that we are going to continue to do. And as I know we're going to get to COVID-19, as I think about how we need to handle COVID-19, we have to think about, yes, the virus, but we have to think about people in the context of where they work, where they live, where they play.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, even in your own backyard in Durham, North Carolina, that whole issue around individuals living in substandard housing or housing complexes, I mean, think about what that was. We have to think differently about how we take care of our citizens. I appreciate that. Yeah. Dr. Cohen, take us through the Department of Health and Human Services. I know, and I mentioned also that we see you on television every day and you're talking about COVID-19, and sometimes that can get lost in all the things that you are responsible for. As Secretary of Health and Human Services, tell us what you do.
Sure. Yes, we have a very large department. We see, and it's really, I'm very lucky to have a number of programs all under the, sort of the same umbrella, because I do think that integration is really important. So we run everything from the Medicaid program, which is insurance coverage for 1 in 5 people in North Carolina. So we're an insurance company. We do mental health services, right? So we also pay for mental health and run mental health services. We do public health, and we're going to get into COVID. That's where all the work with our local health departments, it's the disease tracking, but it's also things like just making sure that our restaurants are safe to eat at, right? So public health, a lot of important work. And then there's a bunch of work on human services side, economic services. So things like food stamps or supplemental nutrition programs or other economic benefits. And then we also run early childhood programs. We run the child care subsidy program, as well as doing the star ratings for child care. And in addition, we have our own state run hospitals and skilled nursing facilities that are across the state. So we have a lot going on. We're 18,000 strong. Like I said, we have a budget of something close to $20 billion a year, that's state and federal dollars. So when I think about that, the opportunity to have those resources go across our state, I want to make sure that they're working for the people of North Carolina. And in order to do that, all of my teams have to work together. It starts with us, right? Working together so that we are making sure to serve the people of North Carolina.
Yeah. And if we think about a big department like that, we think about your top priorities. I'm assuming that you went into this year, 2019 to 2020, with a set of priorities. And I would imagine that those priorities have shifted given the pandemic. Talk us through what are the top priorities for health and human services?
Well, one of our huge priorities going into this year was a focus on early childhood. the science is overwhelming that if you focus on kids, particularly 0 to 5, really getting off to the best start in life, and that means being healthy, being safe, and learning those three pillars, you can really impact someone's lifelong health, lifelong educational attainment. Early childhood is such a pivotal moment for brain development. And so we had a very comprehensive look at how do we invest in kids and families, right? So young kids live in the context of their families. And so how do we support families and kids as we do our work? Sometimes it's, you know, make sure they get their vaccines so they stay healthy. Others, it's working on an issue like infant mortality, where we know that there unfortunately are babies that don't make it to their first year of life. And what we see in that statistic is that in the African American community, folks are twice as babies are twice as likely, sometimes in places three times as likely, not to make it to their first birthday if they're African American, as opposed to if they were born white. And like that's just not acceptable. That is unacceptable on every level to me, and was something that we had a lot of focused energy on and will continue to. But obviously COVID is co-opting a lot of time and energy to that. But early childhood was a huge priority and focus, and we don't want to take our eye off the ball because our kids are too important.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about the pandemic situation that we're in, it just exacerbates all of
that. That's right. And what's so heartbreaking about the whole thing is that we had ongoing disparities in access to care, ongoing disparities in terms of people's health status already. And the virus is just making it worse and putting a spotlight on those already challenging things. And it is our job in the department to use our data and use our tools and resources to respond to the virus and help all of the communities of North Carolina, but pay particular attention to our historically marginalized communities that are unfortunately disproportionately impacted by COVID-19.
Good point. Thank you. So that was a priority. Give me two other priorities that you had coming into this year.
Sure. So the other one we sort of touched on, which is this concept of buying health, where I wanted to use our resources to buy health and bring together health and human services much more closely. So we were gonna use a number of different tools. Some of them are not gonna be ones that we're moving forward with, but one of the key ones I'm really excited about, we actually sped up because of COVID. I know a lot of things seem to like fall away because of COVID, yep. But I'm really excited about one tool, which is called NC Care 360. This is an IT platform that literally brings together health and human services. It helps doctors talk to the community organizations in a way to help that patient that I talked about, right? So when my 24-year-old patient, you know, when we finally got to the root of the issue and she actually needed housing security and food access, I didn't know where to turn, right, as a doctor. I didn't know where to refer her. If she needed a cardiologist, I knew exactly where to send her, but I didn't know where to send her in the community. And what this tool, NC Care 360, does is it allows doctors and nurses and other clinicians to refer people directly to those services in the community, just like they would refer to a cardiologist. And then it allows those in the community to connect back with the doctors. And what I'm excited about is it also connects the community and the different community organizations together. So finally, we're all on a shared platform. We're finally talking the same language. So NC Care 360, it is now, as of, we haven't officially announced this, but as of this week, we are in all 100 counties.
I love breaking news.
Breaking news. We're in all 100 counties, and I'm really proud of the team for speeding up efforts to get that done. But that was a huge priority coming into this year.
Oh, that's huge. When you can create platforms like that, that's transformational.
It's great. It is. I think it's a game changer.
It really is. I'm excited to have a system like that. Transformation in Medicaid. Quickly take us through that, and then we'll jump into the COVID-19.
Yeah. So this was, so before I got here, the General Assembly had made a decision that they were going to privatize Medicaid, that they were going to have Medicaid be administered by private insurance companies. And so there was, you know, when I first got here, there was a lot of thought, are we going to still do that? But, you know, look, most Medicaid programs are run in that way. And so for me, I wanted to take, I said, okay, this is a huge change. It's a huge change in the way Medicaid pays for care. Right now, the state pays directly for care. We're going to use these private insurance companies. My idea was to say, okay, we're going to have this big change. How can we use it to our advantage to drive this agenda around health for our state? And so we had been working for 3 years getting ready to kind of flip the switch and move to managed care. We had selected the private insurance companies. We built the IT systems. And then we didn't have a budget. We didn't have a budget. And you need a budget to do the work. And so we were sort of in a holding pattern, and then COVID happened. And COVID has really destabilized our healthcare system, right? Financially, we're also standing by to surge if we need to respond to the virus. So it has really made it challenging to think about, well, when can we get back to managed care? I think it is a when and not an, you know, an if. But it is definitely not something that I think we will see, certainly not in this calendar year.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think that will happen.
No.
So here you are in North Carolina, you know, Secretary of Health and Human Services. When did this virus come on your radar?
You know, I had heard about it, but it was January of this year. And I remember our team starting to, you know, our public health team starting to track it, but it's not here, but we're starting to hear about it. But the time for me when I said, this is different, and I'm going to be briefed on this every single day now, was when I saw, I don't know if you remember this, there was a viral video that when Wuhan, when they built a hospital in 10 days from the ground up, right, they had this huge area. They just built a hospital in 10 days. I was, my brain almost exploded. Like, I've never seen that happen before, literally never. And so I was like, wow, they know something that I don't know about how serious and how extensive this virus is going to be. If you're going to build a hospital full, you know, from the ground up in 10 days. So that was the moment for me where we started everyday briefings, you know, and the team was already preparing. I don't want to say that they weren't, but that was the click on for me where I was like, we got to prepare here.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're into this. Take us, where are we today with this pandemic, Dr. Cohen?
Yeah. So as I sit here on June the 16th, what I would say is that our case counts are going up. And they are going up at a faster rate than when we were at stay at home. So I think we did early and aggressive action. I think the governor did a fantastic job at really being ahead of things to flatten the curve, because we needed the time. It bought us valuable time to actually build our capability to respond to the virus. I don't know if we were in COVID time, it feels like a long time ago, but it was just in March when we didn't have any protective equipment, right? Remember that whole scare? We didn't have any ability to do testing. We had no surge plans done and all the waivers and all the rules that had to be, we had none of that done. And we've used our time well. Now, we're not perfect. We are still building the plane as we fly it here, but we have taken that time to build all those capabilities. The supply chains are better on protective equipment. We have testing. I mean, we are doing something like nearly 20,000 tests a day in North Carolina. It's a lot of tests, but we're not done. I think we need to be testing even more, but I'm sure we'll get to that. So we are now, what is happening is that our numbers were stable. And so we started to try to ease the restrictions that we had on and come out of stay at home and put some restrictions in place. But we knew we couldn't do that all at once. And so we've been trying to use a slow and steady approach, doing it in phases, even slowing down a bit as we moved into phases. And, you know, we're seeing what we sort of expected, which is when you move around more, the virus is going to move with you. And it's been moving around, and we're seeing it in our communities a lot more. And so where I sit right now is that we are still on an up upward swing. And I would want to see us more stable or declining, but that is not where we are at this moment.
Take us through the science behind the phase approach. We've been dealing with this here at West Southern State University, phase in terms of bringing workers back, you know, so you got this phase approach. What was the science behind, you know, phase one, phase two, phase three?
Sure. So the way the virus spreads most is when people are close together, indoors, for a longer period of time. So we said, okay, those are the higher risk things. So if you think about the way the virus spreads, you actually want the things that are lower risk are when you're outside or you're moving around or when you can be socially distant, right? So the things that come to mind that you should do first are, you know, go for a walk in a park, right? Very low risk. We're learning more about the virus that actually sunlight on the virus, like it can't stay on surfaces in sunlight for very long. So that's a good thing. So outdoors feels a lot lower risk than indoors. So when we moved in the first phase of things, we wanted to try to prioritize activities that were either outside, or if you had to be inside, ones that we weren't sitting down, right? So you actually were moving around. So the sit down activities like restaurants and salons, we tried to keep those to a second phase. We opened retail. So if you wanted to go to the, you know, clothing store or what have you, because at least you're moving, right? At least you're moving indoors and not sitting in one place, which is when the virus actually spreads. The other things that spread the virus a lot is, right, the virus is a respiratory virus. So it comes out of your mouth and your nose. So think about activities in which frankly, spit comes out of your nose and your mouth more often, right? I'm trying not to spit at you.
Okay.
But it's shouting, it's singing, and it's breathing heavy when you exercise, right? It's just, you can kind of visualize that. And so those activities, right, when you're shouting or singing, are one, right? So imagine a loud concert indoors with a lot of people. That makes me very nervous, right? Because you're indoors, you're stationary for a long time, and you're shouting over loud music, right? So those are the kinds of things that are really high risk. It's why we're seeing that there are certain industries where we're seeing more outbreaks, is that when you have to work close together indoors in a loud place that you would maybe have to shout, that those are higher risk setting. So that's how we tried to phase things out. We tried to really understand the science of the virus and say, let's do the low risk things first, right? Go to the park. And then in the second phase, we'll do more risky things like the restaurant or the salon. But we also said we can't do all the risky things all at the same time because we want to see how the virus spreads, right? And what we're seeing is the virus is spreading. The question is, how much is it spreading? Can we do a little bit more opening? Because like, look, we're not getting rid of this virus. We have to live with this virus until there's a vaccine. So the question is, we're just trying to find that right balance between, you know, help, you know, public health and the economy. And both are important, right? And I think that they don't have to be fighting each other. I think there's a way for us to reignite the economy in a way that protects public health. I think that's the balance we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. And we had a big debate in my executive team yesterday. Phase two scheduled to end June 26th.
Yeah.
Will we be going to phase three? Breaking
news.
Breaking news on Future Focus Now. Dr. Cohen.
Yeah, that's right. Nice try. That's a decision for the governor. And he'll be making it soon, right? We obviously know that is coming up. So next week we'll be sharing more on that. And look, and we want to look at our trends and the thing, you know, what we are really looking at, and we're very transparent about that. All of our metrics are right up on our dashboard every day. You know, it's the rate of acceleration. We're looking at rates of acceleration in cases, in hospitalization, in how we're doing with testing. So those are all of the things that we're going to try to put into our thinking. And again, we're not trying to say there's going to be no spread. Like, that's not the goal. The goal is to keep the spread low enough that we don't overwhelm our healthcare system, right? Because when people get sick and they get sick all at the same time, that's when we have the problem.
Yeah.
So that's what we just need to judge. And look, there is a lot of art to this. Like, there's not a perfect science here. There is a lot of give and take here that we're trying to understand the numbers and the science in order to make some of these decisions. But I think going slow and steady is really tells us that the science tells us, you know, do slow and steady, watch your metrics, and then go from there.
I think in North Carolina, I think we've done a great job in terms of being respectful to the citizens of this state, but what you, your staff, the governor has done. Can you share with me, and this is somewhat of a delicate question, but when you think about the science of this, there's a science of this, there's the economics of this, and there's the politics of this. Can you talk about those three variables and how they intersect in getting us to making a decision?
Sure. I would say that we really want to use the science and data to drive our decision-making, but we also know that this is a virus we've never seen before, right? And we are in unprecedented times, and so there are limitations in terms of the science and the data. We don't have the precision to know if we do this, then this will happen exactly. So there is, like I said, there is some unknown here, but we also know that only thinking about COVID-19 and not thinking about health more broadly, right, that we talked about the first half, you have to think more broadly. And economics also impacts health, right, and whether people have jobs and their ability to maintain their health insurance, all of those things, right, contribute to our ability to be healthy as a state. So it's not a clear picture, and you sort of have to take in all of that feedback. We work with the business community and try to understand that. We try to take in all that data and the science and speak to a lot of experts. And we try not to make this about politics. And I think that has largely been true here in North Carolina, is that we've the things that we are focusing on are the data and the economics here, and trying to find that middle ground. And I think that there's been a lot of support on both sides of the aisle for that. I think some people have, you know, a lean one way and a lean the other way, but I think all want to find this middle ground. No one wants to overwhelm our healthcare system, and no one wants to devastate our economy permanently, right? And so we all want to find that middle ground. And it's just been interesting to me to see people, individuals, has nothing to do with politics. Individuals just assess risk in their own lives differently. I can give you the same statistic, and I can say it two different ways, and they will both be true, but they just see it different ways. So here, I'll give you the same statistic. We've had 1,000 deaths from COVID-19 in North Carolina. That is three times worse than our worst flu season. That's a true statement. Mm-hmm. Here, I'll say it again. COVID-19 has caused 1,000 deaths out of 10 million people in North Carolina. Also a true statement, So those are both true, and you can imagine different people with different risk tolerances for that, hearing that, saying that, and saying, oh, it's three times worse than flu. Okay, that's terrible. Another person being like, wait a second, there's only 1,000 deaths out of 10 million and we're shutting down the economy? We have to hear both of those things, integrate them into our thinking, and then find a way forward.
Yeah,
that helps.
I finally started venturing out a little bit, going out, and I religiously wear my mask. But
yay.
I'll tell you, Dr. Cohen, I go out, I see a lot of people not wearing masks.
Yeah.
Some conversations I heard with you and the governor talking about the possibility of requiring mm-hmm. folks to wear masks. Yeah. We have spent a great deal of time at West Salem State thinking about requiring, you know, workers, students to wear masks. Take us through where we are without thinking about masks and why that's important.
Well, look, I think face coverings is incredibly important. We don't have a lot of tools here to fight this virus. Particularly not a lot of tools that are pretty inexpensive, right? Testing and the tracing and isolate, all those things are very expensive tools. One of the very least expensive tools, though I know it's annoying, is a face covering. And what I would say is the data is becoming stronger and stronger with every passing day. There are more published studies about the importance of face covering. And the reason for that is that COVID-19 can be spread well before you have symptoms, right? You can feel perfectly well for many, many days, but be contagious and be spreading COVID to your friends, to your family, to your school colleagues, and you just don't know. And so that's where the face covering comes in, is that you could have it and you don't want to be giving it to your friends and you just don't know. And so that's why it's if everybody does it, right, it is one of those phenomena where everyone has to work together here on the face coverings. And, you know, I'm with you. I've seen a lot of people wear masks. I've seen a lot of people not. And so, you know, we have said all the time, we are seeing our numbers go the wrong direction. We want to keep the economy open, right? And so we don't have a lot of tools. We don't want to go back to stay at home. So, right, that's one of the tools in the toolkit that we are assessing. We're looking at the data. But again, we want to work with the business community on this and figure out the right way to do this, because it's not just about a rule or a law. You know, everyone's going to have to, you know, understand why we're doing this and do this together.
Yeah. And we are continuing to see the virus spread. And you talked about health disparities. I'm concerned about the new data about the trends and the uptick and with the Latinx community in certain parts of the state. And so talk a little bit about the health disparities part of this and how you're focusing your efforts in those areas.
Yes, it's a really important topic. And COVID-19 is shining a light on the already existing disparities that we have in North Carolina. And frankly, we see around the country, unfortunately. But we're seeing both the Latinx and the African American community be disproportionately impacted, and it's not, unfortunately, is because of job, you know, likely exposure, right? There are folks who are in jobs where you don't show up for work, you don't get paid. They're in jobs where it's very consumer facing, or there's a lot of, you know, person to person interaction in those jobs. And then you don't realize you have it, and you bring it home to your family or to your church or what have you, and then it spreads through the community. So that's why we're trying to really work with partners in those communities. I mean, look, you layer COVID and then you layer on everything that's going on in terms of the racial inequities and the last few weeks of protests, right, rightly shining a light on a huge, huge issue. But there is a huge distrust in government right now, understandably, right? At an all-time low of trust in government at a time where you were started by talking about trust, right? And I actually really, I'm really happy to hear that there is trust there, because I know it is a low trust time for government. And I work very hard to make sure folks know that I am working hard for them every single day in every community. But it is also why we have to partner with folks like yourself and in every community where they know their communities best. And so that is what we are trying to do to make sure that we can respond to COVID-19.
Thank you. At Winston-Salem State University, we are a higher ed institution, and there's been a lot of discussions about universities and students returning to campus, and we've been working extremely hard, doing all the right things, asking all the right questions. What advice would you give us as we prepare for students to return to a college campus, and do you think that we will be able to accommodate them this fall?
It's a great question. I would say we have to continue to look at our numbers. I think we are going in to plan. I will say my top priority is bringing our K-12 kids back to school. K-12 kids, we know, are actually less impacted by the virus. And so we're going to work hard to get those kids back to school. So I think about higher ed and challenges. I think CDC has put out some really good guidance for higher ed and to thinking about cohorting and distancing and infection control and hygiene and cleaning and all those things. So I won't get into that, because I do think that's really good guidance. You know, I have leaned on Bill Roper as the interim chancellor at UNC, former CDC director. I mean, how lucky are we, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, Bill is a, you know, a friend and a mentor, and I turn to him for advice. So, you know, really get taking his advice on how do we get kids back safely, particularly for, we know that they're going to pull from all parts of the country, in addition to all parts of our state, which could have higher prevalence of COVID-19 and bring it back here to North Carolina. So for me as a state official, I am worried about an influx of virus when students come back. And so we're trying to think through that and making sure that folks are really being alert to symptoms and exposure and testing and tracing and isolating, right? People who live in the dorms are going to potentially need to be in a separate place if they are COVID-19 positive. So you need to be thinking that through in terms of options if they have a roommate, to not make sure they're in the same place and using a shared bathroom with others.
And you know, alumni, they're always interested in events, homecoming, football games. What's the latest on large gatherings?
Yeah, large gatherings is going to be a problem until we have a vaccine. Let me just be blunt. that one's a real challenge, right? I want to bring kids back to school, right? Because I want learning to happen. But when I think about some of those, I know we love them. We love our football. We love our, you know, our concerts, all the things. But mass gatherings and this virus just don't mix. They do not mix. And I think that is going to be a place where we're not going to be able to do those kinds of large gatherings until either we have a vaccine or we have some sort of medicine that can treat the virus. So that's one that's going to, I can't give you a hopeful nod on that one.
Yeah. I appreciate that. So one of the questions I want to ask you, because we're almost out of time, but I ask people to send me questions, and I think as a physician, you can speak to this. This is a question I got from Wendy Brenner, and she talks about families who have loved ones with Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. and they're in care yeah. facilities. Yeah. And she said, you know, with terminal diseases, with limited time, and they deteriorate faster when they're isolated. I think that she was just struggling. She's talking about her mom, and we know there are countless situations like this. How do we look at these situations and then also think about the health of all of us?
Yeah. Ugh. This is one of those excruciating kinds of decisions, right? Because I just talked about the importance of whole person health and mental health, and that social interaction so important, both for the person who's residing in a nursing home as well as the family. Let's be honest, like that's really important. And it has been one of, you know, it's a gut-wrenching decision to say you can't do visitation. You know, I'm trying to help folks understand the link between when we spread virus at a restaurant and what happens in our long-term care. It can seem so separate. But when we have more virus circulating in our communities from at whatever setting, that is going to actually impact those that live in long-term care settings, right? The more virus we see, it comes into those settings. And that's when they're the most medically frail, right? They're the most likely to get COVID-19 and die from it. And so it's this really hard tension. And so I have a perfect answer. We're trying to, you know, feel our way through it with the data and the science. We're doing everything we can to protect folks in other ways, right? So we sent protective equipment to every nursing home in North Carolina to, you know, use protective equipment and those kind of things. We've paid them more and paid them differently to work on infection control. But even with all, you know, testing more, and even with all those things, it is really, really challenging. And I think we are, you know, I wish there was a better answer that we would have here, but I just don't.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of the saddest things about this pandemic, not to be kind of close to your loved ones. I know. This time, it's been devastating.
Yeah.
You're a physician, Dr. Cohen, you miss practice?
I do, in the way that practicing medicine can give you this immediate reaction from a person, right? Something is wrong. You try to figure it out and hopefully you fix it, right? Something, you give them a prescription or whatever, and you can fix something. And that feels good in the moment, right? In that moment. So I miss the immediacy of being able to interact with someone, learn about them and their family, and then try to help them out of a hard situation, whether it's a medical situation or other. So I miss that part of it, because the work I do now is about longer term planning and longer term impact on many, many, many more people, I hope. But it's sometimes you don't get to see some of those faces. And luckily I have the opportunity to make sure that I stay as close as I can to that. But I am not practicing medicine and have not since I've been in North Carolina. Just this job is a big job, and so haven't had room for that. The only extra job that I add to the resume is mom when I'm not secretary. So I'm just so I miss it, but I feel like this is where I'm meant to be.
Absolutely. And lastly, how are you?
Oh, this is hard. This is hard. I'm not going to lie. This is definitely the hardest thing I've done. We've had big ups and downs in this, and some downs are really hard. I mean, think about the question we were just talking about, long-term care. These are excruciating. I mean, how do you sleep when you're trying to make that kind of decision? I mean, or when you have to say, I can't open a particular business. My brother and his wife are performers. They're not going to be working for the next year, right? They're in New York. They perform on Broadway. How can I sleep, right? When that kind of thing is weighing on you every day. So it is really hard. I'm lucky. I have a wonderful team. I work for a wonderful governor. A lot of really good people, but this is really hard. So I don't want anyone to think that we make any of these decisions lightly, and that we lose sleep over every single one of them.
I mean, incredible. We are lucky in North Carolina to have you in the seat that you sit in. We thank you so much. I mean, you have been so generous with your time. You've been so gracious. We're going to have you back. I'm going to have you back on the show. And nice. When you come back on the show, I'm going to have you sing. Because I know that you are a singer, and I know you play the piano and all of that. You're going to come back and do a piece for us, Dr. Coleman. Cohen, excuse me. We're going to have you come back.
Nice. But I hope the next time, though, is when the virus has passed us, we have a vaccine, and we'll do it in person, and we can sing together.
Absolutely. We'll do it.
Nice. I love it.
Thank you so much. You have a great night. Hug the kids. We look forward to seeing you, giving us a briefing tomorrow.
That's all right.
Take care of yourself.
All right. Great to be with you. All right, everyone. Have a good night. Stay well.
Good night.
Bye-bye.